Part 5 of Great Decisions, looking at the disputes over public protests, which ruled a good part of the 20th century, sponsored again by Becky Navikatz, Le'ila Nishmas Yonah ben Rab Aryeh Leib. So this remains one of the most controversial and much discussed issues in Jewish life until today. What is the value, what is the propriety of protests or demonstrations in some contexts, even physical assaults in order to protect Jewish rights or defend Jews in various parts of the world or promote Jewish interests? Or are Jews better off engaging in quiet diplomacy? Since the 17th century, we used an institution called the Shtadlon. The Shtadlon traditionally represented Jewish interests and interceded with the ruling authorities. And it was an official position that the Jewish community maintained. Maybe that works. There's several issues, of course. What works better? What's more effective, which after all should be the ultimate goal? Or is there a redeeming value in having the Jewish community engaged rather than relying on one or two people? So to what extent should we consider the effects of public protest, for example, on the indigenous Jewish community, or even on the community that's being targeted for assistance but instead might be targeted for retaliation? And who decides? Who makes these decisions? It's interesting that we have instances of public diplomacy bearing fruit even in an American context at a relatively early age in our recent history. After the Damascus blood libel in 1840, the Jewish community here, numbering around 15,000 souls and led by Isaac Lisa, we discussed a few weeks ago, held public meetings and protests and urged the chief magistrate of the United States, which is what the president was called back then, to use, I quote, his moral influence that would be under heaven the best aid we could invoke for the protection of our persecuted brethren under the Mohammedan domain. And President Martin Van Buren, the eighth president, responded, sharply condemning the arrests and torture of Jews in Damascus and sending two American ambassadors to convey the horror of the U.S. government at the treatment of those Jews. Within a short time, the torture stopped and the Jews were released. There was a similar public protest and presidential reaction to the Kishinev pogrom in 1903, leading Theodore Roosevelt to write to Tsar Nicholas II very succinctly, "Stop your cruel oppression of the Jews." And all this came about because Jews intercede with the administration and held public protests. But these were fairly obvious instances where American involvement came at little cost, and the civilized world was aroused. The three cases we'll discuss tonight were seen as more nuanced, even if they each occupied different points on the sliding scale of evil. The disputes over public protests against Nazi Germany, for Soviet Jewry, and against the Oslo process. Now, of course, they're not all the same. But what makes them similar is that in each case, there are at least two points of view, sometimes more. There are always people who strongly supported public protests and boycotts and demonstrations, etc. Always people who favored private diplomacy and working within the system behind the scenes, and people who wanted to do nothing in fear that doing something will only make things worse. Interestingly, all three on some level became intertwined, and the tactics used or shunned in one were abandoned or borrowed for another. In each case, lessons were learned from the prior cases, sometimes good lessons, sometimes the wrong lessons. We'll show a brief clip here that relates to the American Jewish response to the boycott, rise of Nazi Germany, the late 30s in the United States. And once again, I want to thank the Destiny Foundation for their very kind license to use these materials. Hold on 1 second and we'll start.
The Neutrality Act, passed by the United States Congress in November 1939, signaled to England and France that America would not come to their aid if they went to war with Germany.
from Berlin and copying the methods of Berlin.
In this charged atmosphere, Jewish communal leaders in the U.S. assumed a low profile, which would continue throughout World War II. Condemnation of Hitler and his brutality towards Jews was muted, and little was done to persuade the U.S. government to allow Jewish refugees to enter America.
There was a great deal of open anti-Semitism and discrimination and bigotry against Jews. You couldn't go to every hotel. You couldn't go to every university. You couldn't be the chairman of a Forbes 500 company. And there was a quota against Jewish immigration. And the Jews in the United States hunkered down. They also were going to ride it out. And that weakened any influence they could have on the American government.
All right, it was a brief clip, but takes us to a world that seems eons ago, but in fact, it's almost 75 years ago.
We weren't the only ones who used that far rally for the Holocaust that became a template from which all future activism would be judged. And it remains, looms large. It's a failed and mostly unsuccessful form of activism of American Jewry. But in many areas of Jewish life today, the Holocaust casts a very dark shadow. The cliché abounds that American Jews did little to save European Jewry during the Holocaust. But historians argue both the veracity of that statement as well as its import, that is to say, if Jews had done more, what exactly could they have done? And what would have made a difference? Neither is very easy an answer. There was certainly timidity, and there was certainly misplaced reliance on government officials, including FDR, who had the Jews bamboozled by the number of Jews in his inner circle, most of whom did very little to help, and by the access that he dangled in front of other Jews. It's not an unfamiliar dynamic today. People think access is influence. Access is not influence. Access today, unfortunately, is used for its own sake. I'll take the Jonathan Powell case of the rest of the world. Jews who have the president's ear, whether the president was the first Bush or Clinton, or the second Bush or Obama, almost never use their access to lobby on his behalf. Jews who do lobby for Pollard are denied future access to the White House. I can tell that from personal experience. In the end, access exists for domestic Jewish purposes, for the photo op, for looking and feeling important, rather than really accomplishing anything on the part of the Jewish people. In fact, I'm hard-pressed to think of any particular matter of importance to Jews in the last 20 years, 30 years, even 40 years, where a president's mind was changed as a result of the intercession of a Jewish friend or advisor. It could be, I just don't know of any. Add to the matter of Nazi Germany the fact that despite the disproportionate presence of Jews in Roosevelt's inner circle, as you saw in the clip, Jewish standing in America was insecure. Jews were still the victims of open persecution. Jews did not feel fully at home in America. Jews had inferiority complex that prevented many from calling special attention to parochial Jewish needs. And especially the Jews who were most known to the public were trending towards assimilation and intermarriage and the hiding of their Jewish identity and not the public identification of Jewish needs. So how did American Jews respond to the rise of Nazi Germany? We always have to say, hindsight is 20/20. And we look back on the ghastliness of the Nazi regime, and we're horrified that Hitler wasn't stopped. But it wasn't clear to all for sure that he meant what he said when he said it. In retrospect, we take his words now seriously, like I said before, it guides us until today. We take our Ahmadinejad's words seriously only because of Hitler. In 1933, when Hitler first assumed power and began his discrimination and persecution of Jews, Jewish stores led a boycott of German goods. Already in 1933, Jewish stores that are well known to many of us here. A&S, Lord & Taylor, B. Altman, Saks Fifth Avenue, all Jewish stores, etc., others as well. And yet, to take one example, Walter Lippmann, famed columnist and embarrassed Jew, was very critical of the boycotts. And he called Hitler, I quote, the authentic voice of a genuinely civilized people. That's where he came from, with Lippmann. Many others, Jews especially, held that boycotts would only enrage Hitler and harm German Jews. Thus, a Jewish call to the United States to boycott the Berlin Olympics in 1936 was roundly dismissed by many Jews and by the official ones as well, with Avery Brundage, who's the head man of the United States Olympic Committee, saying Jews are suffering from radicalism and self-seeking, putting their personal advantage before the welfare of the race. And he refused to consider a boycott of the games. Of course, we would encounter Avery Brundage again in 1972, and as the head of the International Olympic Committee, he was the one who insisted that the games must go on after the 11 Israeli athletes were murdered by Arab terrorists. In the 1930s, Jew hatred in America was not at all dormant, and therefore Jews were not quick to respond. Prominent Jews at first opposed the boycott of Germany. René Grimm formed a joint conference committee already in 1933 to monitor Nazi activities, but ruled out public protests. They preferred to work behind the scenes. This outraged one of the few genuine activists, the former rabbi Stephen Weiss, who became the most outspoken American Jewish figure against self-restraint and in favor of public action. So when he called for a rally in Madison Square Garden in 1933, this is just a few months after Hitler took power, the establishment flipped out. Among them, Judge Joseph Proskauer, known to every lawyer here, named Parker, a famous law firm in New York, the head of the American Jewish Committee, said that if the rally takes place, mind you, 1933, I quote, the blood of German Jewry will be on Weiss's head. The German embassy called Weiss twice to cancel the rally, but it occurred anyway. It was March 27, 1933. 22,000 people inside the garden, 30,000 more outside the garden, prominent politicians in attendance. When the Nazis ordered a boycott of Jewish merchants in Germany beginning the following week, the American Jewish Committee, and they blamed Stephen Weiss for that. And Proskauer, for example, always opposed an American Jewish boycott of German goods, even in the late 30s, even to the war. And Weiss said at one time, it's ongoing, of course, but Weiss said, I quote, the time for prudence and caution is past. We must speak up like men. How can we ask our Christian friends to lift their voices in protest against the wrong suffered by Jews if we keep silent? Eventually, Weiss had to start his own organization, which is the traditional Jewish way, called the World Jewish Congress, still exists because the establishment was meek. He brushed away all criticism that his activism was hurting America, saying, I've been an American all my life, but I've been a Jew for 4,000 years. But even Weiss stumbled repeatedly, particularly his relationship with FDR, with whom he claimed a friendship. Well, it was a friendship that was decidedly one-sided, and which Weiss would never jeopardize by asking FDR for anything, or even criticizing him for anything. Thus, all the prominent Jewish Democrats, and there were many, could not convince the federal government in the 1930s to issue a statement condemning the Nazi treatment of Jews. And they failed miserably in trying to get the government to adopt more liberal immigration policies for Jews. They even failed to get the government to fill its quota of Jews. One of the most troubling developments of the 30s. In the 30s, with the walls of tyranny closing in on German Jewry, German Jewish immigration was pathetically small. 1,372 Jews in 1933, 4,137 in 1934, 4,837 in 1935. In 1937, it reached 5,800 Jews, but was still far below the legal quota. FDR routinely blamed the State Department, justifiably so, but he was not ready to pick a fight with the state or with the American people that opposed immigration on the grounds that the United States could not afford to sustain its own people, including the president, so why bring in more poor people? And this applied, of course, not only to German Jews, but to Jews across the rest of the continent. The truth is, most Americans supported, more Americans supported ending all immigration than supported increased immigration. So from 1933 to 1941, just as an example, about 104,000 German Jews entered the United States. The quota was 212,000. So simply 108,000 slots were not used, only because the State Department did not grant the visas. Jew hatred was also a factor, as we saw. Many Americans resented the prominence of Jews in FDR's administration. Even took to calling the New Deal the Jew Deal. Roberto Roosevelt was a Jew, Rosenfeld, Rosenberg. As you saw, the German-American Bund were very patriotic defenders of Germany, even under Hitler. And that rally that you saw at Madison Square Garden took place in February 1939, only 7 months before World War II started. Roosevelt himself was a master of misdirection. He formed committees. He held conferences, but he accomplished nothing except lull the Jews into silence and acquiescence and repeated support for him at the election polls. His first advisory committee was established in 1938. That produced the Evian Conference on Jewish Refugees, in which the working assumption going in was that no nation, including the U.S., had to or would change its refugee immigration policies, which by then were the only way of saving Jews. Later, during the war, the Bermuda Refugee Conference took place in 1943, and we have similar non-results. Yad Vashem, with history, characterized the Bermuda Conference as designed to, quote, shush the growing public outcries to the rest of European Jewry, without actually having to find any solutions to the problem. Back up a little, after Kristallnacht in November 1938, the American Jewish Congress opposed sectarian Jewish protests. In fact, FDR denounced the pogrom, saying in a news conference, I myself could scarcely believe that such things could occur in a 20th century civilization, but basically did nothing. Remember, it was his administration that refused to allow the St. Louis to dock in Miami after they were turned away from Cuba, in which they had visas that were then disallowed. Ultimately, winding up back in Europe in June 1939, less than 3 months before the Nazis went to war. The Jews did establish committees to lobby for rescue efforts, especially to send money and goods to European Jews. The joint and other groups were active, working through Switzerland and other countries, saving children, smuggling out other Jews, but it was minimal. The Bat Hatzalah was founded in 1939 under the leadership of Rabbi Eliezer Silver. At first, to save rabbis and yeshiva students, and during the war, all Jews that they could, and they were very active in a number of spheres. And unlike almost every other Jewish group that acted, except one, they did not feel encumbered by American law, which they routinely violated on grounds of Pekuach Nefesh. One memorable story, Robert Kalmanevich, the mayor of Yeshiva, was sending money behind enemy lines for federal crime. The FBI visited him and told them, you might as well arrest me. But I tell you, when I come out from prison, I'll continue doing the same thing I'm doing now. And in fact, they just let him be. But Stephen Weiss opposed the efforts of the Bat Hatzalah. He was rescued, among others, of Aaron Cutler, from David Lipschitz, from Ruben Brzozowski, from Avram Yaffin, and many others as well. Also very active, but very unsolicitous of the opinions of the establishment Jewish organizations, was the Bergson Group. We had a video about them a year ago or so, led by Peter Bergson, the alias of Hillel Cook. Hillel Cook was the nephew of Ralph Cook. Peter Bergson organized rallies, put the ads in newspapers. He was very prominent, very public, very in your face. He enlisted the help of the Hollywood community, some known as Jews, some not, and Edward G. Robinson, and he repeatedly pressured politicians to act. And acting wasn't easy. Jewish congressmen like Manny Seller, Manny Seller's a congressman from Brooklyn for about 150 years, I think. 50 years, I don't know, 150 years, until Elizabeth Holtzman beat him in 1972. 50 years, 1970. Saul Bloom from Manhattan, the Garment District, they tried to pass immigration legislation but without any meaningful success. I stumbled again in 1942. In July, he was one of two people to receive a cable from Gerhard Riegner, the representative of the WJC in Geneva, with the first corroborated details of the final solution. It's July 1942. Wise brought to Sucker Wells, on the Secretary of State, who urged him to sit on it and do nothing, and Wise did until November 1942. By that time, the Treblinka had, those several months, had already murdered the hundreds of thousands of Jews. Thereafter, meetings with FDR received sympathy, but were just referred to the State Department. Even later, requests to bomb the railroad leading to Auschwitz were rejected as having no military necessity, even though factories just 2 miles away from the death camps were being bombed. Bergson arranged a mass public rally at Madison Square Garden in March 1943, together with a theatrical production called We Shall Never Die, which he then took on the road across the country. But again, it had little support from the establishment Jewish organizations. Now, part of the impetus of Bergson's work, besides the silence of the official Jewish community, was the failure of the media, the gross failure of the especially Jewish-owned media, like the New York Times or Washington Post, to write about the Holocaust at any length, with any substance, with any frequency. Abe Rosenthal wrote a book about 10, 15 years ago, after your time, that's right, detailing the acquiescence of the times in the slaughter of Jews, essentially, over the course of the whole Holocaust. They had made 8 or 9 stories, and even reports that 600,000 they killed at Treblinka wound up in a little column on page 7 in 1943, completely discounted. So despite the revelations about the death camps, because of the Riegner cable, everyone knew what was going on by the fall of 1942. Already, still in early 1943, a Gallup poll showed that while 47% of the American public believed that a Holocaust was taking place, 29% dismissed it as a rumor, and 24% had no opinion. And I add that at that time, the Holocaust still had another 2 years to go, another 4 million Jews to murder, but still few were aroused to do anything. It was another major event, at least in my perspective, and that was the famous Rabbi's March on Washington. On October 6, 1943, 400 rabbis descended on the nation's capital. It was 2 days before Yom Kippur. Note this well. It was the only public demonstration by Jewish leaders in the nation's capital during the entire war. I'll let that sink in. But Wise told FDR to ignore them. They're not really representative of the Jewish community. And Roosevelt literally slipped out the back of the White House so he'd be able to say he wasn't in the White House when the rabbis came calling. In fact, Vice President Wallace met them for a few moments, and that was it. And nothing was accomplished, save for some impetus to the creation of the War Refugee Board that was formed in January 1944. Now that was formed primarily in response to threats from an official in the Department of the Treasury named Josiah Dubois, that he would resign and he would expose the administration's obstructions what he called sabotage in refugee relief. And that was intolerable, 1944 being an election year. Dubois and a few others, John Bell, had prepared a memorandum that they submitted to Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of the Treasury, and he then became active after this. The memo was submitted in December 1943, entitled, Report to the Secretary on the Acquiescence of This Government in the Murder of the Jews. A devastating title, much less report. Despite it was formed, the War Refugee Board began its work in January 1944, and despite its limited abilities, it wound up saving some 200,000 Jewish refugees, making it all the more repugnant that it was not established earlier in the war. In sum, the reaction of American Jews to the Holocaust was ultimately tepid, self-protective, and substantive, but in a very refined, very limited sort of way. Rav Zatzal regretted that there never was a public day of prayer or fasting called, like Mordechai did, for example, in Shushan. But the truth is there was. But of 4 million American Jews at the time, less than 100,000 participated, even tangentially, in any event surrounding the rescue of Jews. As one historian put it, I quote, no American Jew appeared to have altered his lifestyle once news of the Holocaust was revealed. People were sad, but they were not moved to do anything about it, when they could have done something about it. Of course, after the war, American Jews rallied around refugees and donated money for the Holocaust memorials, supported Israel, but during the Holocaust years, it was very little done that was effective. The truth is, it's an American pattern. Americans have good aspirations, we frequently speak of our aspirations, but the truth is, until today, Americans generally bemoan massacres after the fact, but do little to intervene to thwart them before they happen, or to stop them while they are happening. In that sense, the Holocaust is no different from the massacres in Cambodia, or Rwanda, or Darfur, or Syria today. Don't look very far. Only saving grace for American Jews is the lingering sense that nothing they could have done would have mattered much unless they were willing to take away their support for Roosevelt, which probably would never have happened. The sad fact is, in the face of absolute evil, only absolute and relentless good stands a chance. So the question then became, how would American Jews respond to something that was less than an absolute evil? The communist regime in the Soviet Union that persecuted Jews from 1917 on. With no exaggeration at all, to underscore that the Holocaust played a significant role in shaping American Jews' attitude in response to the Soviet Union's treatment of Jews and the demand by Jews for free immigration. The response was almost the exact opposite of the Holocaust, and intentionally so. Now, it really didn't start with Soviet Jewry. The fact is, Jews first intervened with the American government to stop the violence and mistreatment of Jews in Argentina in 1964, a decade later than in Syria. But Jews here became involved in the as a tool of diplomacy, as a geopolitical instrument in the Cold War. So in 1961, for example, Romania sent its chief rabbi, Rav Moshe Rosen, to America as a way to open the doors to favorable treatment in Washington, especially trade and economic relations. Rav Moshe Rosen gave a shiur in YU. He also spoke glowingly, not altogether truthfully, about Romania, Jewish life in Romania. He was a hired hand. In 1965, in response to his efforts, America gave Romania most favored nation trading status, and Romania then became the valuable intermediary between East and West. From 1967 to 75, 140,000 Jews emigrated from Romania. So even during the Cold War, during the 35 and the 60s and the early 90s, Romania was the only country in the communist bloc whose Jews could emigrate freely. But here, Jews were used in the middle, and everyone benefited from it. In 1956, great David Mauser, who brought home the president of the RCA, and he was the very first rabbinical delegation to the Soviet Union. Spoke at the shul in Moscow. Still, I heard accounts of it. He flew with tears and heartbreak. Most of his audience broke down when he spoke to them in Yiddish, and most had no idea that any religious Jew but them had survived the Holocaust. And Rabbi Hollander, I knew him well. He was a real gavro. He was a pioneer. He was a relentless activist for Soviet Jews, and that just pervaded his entire life. The first real act of protest was the Matzah demonstration in 1962. After the Soviets had curtailed the production of matzah, a number of students came to the Soviet mission in New York and were invited in during their demonstration and were told the policy would be rectified. It attracted media coverage, and that bodes well for the future. In the course of my research, I uncovered a name, one of our members, and I confirmed with him at Neil Kamar tonight. That in fact, he was one of the leaders of this group who went to the Soviet mission, and they ensured the continued supply of matzah. And what was odd is that they responded to it. They would never again be that responsible. When the Soviet Jewry movement started, Soviet Jews, quote by Elie Wiesel, the Jews of Silence, numbered almost 3 million souls. They had suffered grievously during the Holocaust, and during Stalin's paranoia in the late 1940s until his death. Already in 1953, Ben-Gurion established Israeli intelligence links to Soviet Jewry that never ended. By the mid-1960s, Zionist cells operated, as we know, all came to life after the Six-Day War. Immediately, non-Russian Jews from the Baltic states and the Asian republics, remember the USSR had 16 different republics, non-Russians applied to emigrate, as was their right under the Soviet Constitution, and the Kremlin agreed, hoping this would forestall a similar demand from Russian Jews. It didn't. Thousands, to their horror, thousands of non-Russian Jews applied to leave, followed by tens of thousands of Russian Jews. And then the authorities slammed shut the door of immigration long before the communists had banned the open study of Torah, of the Hebrew language, even the publication of the Jewish calendar, and soon Jews who had applied to emigrate were fired from their jobs, the kids got out of school, etc. They became the prisoners of Zion or the refusers. Now, already in 1964, the student circle of the Soviet Jewry had been founded by Jacob Birnbaum, one of his close associates, who's now the homeline. And Birnbaum tried with modest success to arouse the Jewish community again in 1964. Len Richter was another longtime activist. Almost at the same time, Moshe Dechter convened what he called the Conference on the Status of Soviet Jews, with many prominent people in attendance, including Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, Martin Luther King came. It was the first major public event in 1964, but the long-term effect was minimal. The immediate result was we formed a committee. The American Conference on Soviet Jewry was formed, later became the National Conference on Soviet Jewry, NCSJ. The world attention was really focused on Soviet Jews for the first time. Once they clamped down on emigration in June 1970, failed hijacking at the Leningrad airport. So all the accused bought all the tickets on a small plane that they would fly to Sweden. Less than 30 minutes to freedom from St. Petersburg. They were arrested at the airport. People became very famous. Edward Kuznetsov, Sylvan Malmstrom, Joseph Mendelevich, Mark Dushitz had been a pilot in the military who fly the plane. So at the trial, the defendants denounced Soviet repression. They were all sentenced to long prison terms. First two were sentenced to death, and their sentences were commuted after an international protest. But the Leningrad trial is the movement, the Soviet Jewry movement, new momentum as a reaction of the American government looking for propaganda victories over the Soviets, and a reaction of the official Jewish community shocked the Soviet Union. They had tremendous pride in communism and did not like to think they were the moral inferiors to anyone. and the realization dawned that the Soviets would respond to pressure, and in fact their economy was always rickety, and so they needed American assistance in a number of ways. It was then, 1970-71, that the Jewish Defense League took the violent route, starting first with Franks, and then in the early 1970s escalating to attacks on Soviet diplomats, bombing the Soviet mission in New York, cultural activities, trade offices. Mayor Kahana, I shouldn't come to know, was involved in some but not all of these activities, including in Aliyah in 1971. In February 1971, a major world conference dealing with Soviet Jewry was convened in Brussels. Kahana was there, but politicians showed up. Even Ben-Gurion himself showed up. Whatever one feels about the violence, it was a stark contrast to what had occurred or did not occur during the Holocaust. I don't recall reading a single account of any attack on any German, diplomat or otherwise, in America in the 30s and the 40s. So for sure there was a cumulative effect. Rallies, again, Madison Square Garden, they make a lot of money off people suffering there. Rallies at the Garden and elsewhere kept the issue before the public eye. The first Solidarity Sunday occurred in 1972, became an annual event between the establishment, the SSSJ, the JDL, and the rallies was slight progress. In 1971, 50,000 Jews left. In 72, 32,000 Jews left, but 70% were from the Asian republics that were permitted to leave under the Soviet Constitution. When the educated Jews applied to leave, then the Soviet clamped down again, and they required what they called the payment of diploma taxes, meaning the government had to be reimbursed for educating these traders who were now leaving. If you had a college degree, that cost $12,200 to leave. Doctors, $18,400. Science PhDs, $20,000. That was real money back then, especially the Soviet Jews. Scientists were more valuable than doctors, what can I tell you? Quickly, emigration slowed to a trickle, and then the issue became tangled in geopolitics, which really had the greatest impact of all. Now, the American government, you'll all recall, except the young people here, was very keen on its policy of détente with the Soviet Union, détente French for relaxation, as a relaxation of tensions. Henry Kissinger proved to be a tremendous obstacle to the Soviet Jewry movement. I mean, people knew it back then, but it's obvious today. Just a year or two ago, maybe 3 years ago, they released some White House tapes that show that right after Golda Meir left the Oval Office on March 1st, 1973, after asking Nixon to pressure the Soviets to allow Jewish immigration, Kissinger said to Nixon, and I quote, "The immigration of Jews from the Soviet Union is not an objective of American foreign policy. And if they put Jews in the gas chambers in the Soviet Union, it is not an American concern. Maybe a humanitarian concern." Note the maybe. And Nixon responded, "I know, we can't blow up the world because of it." So Nixon promised quiet diplomacy. And he won some concessions from the Soviets, but it wasn't enough. And a great champion of Jewish rights emerged in the Senate, Washington Senator, conservative Democrat, Henry Scoop Jackson, who pushed the issue. And he, together with his aide, Richard Burroughs, who has been famous the last 20 years as well, one of the great neocons, Richard Burroughs, Morris Amitai, who was an aide to Abe Ribicoff, Connecticut Senator, and others, Javits, Humphrey, Birch Bayh, they promoted legislation linking trade with the Soviets to free immigration. It was not an easy sell endangering American-Soviet relations because of the Jews. And of course, the lesson didn't say that. It didn't say the Soviets, but it did link unnamed countries and their human rights policies, especially their immigration policies, with trade rights with America. One thing sustained the whole movement, and that was the Holocaust, and the relative silence of American Jews during the Holocaust. Pearl and Amitai specifically referenced Jewish silence during the Holocaust time and again, and as a reason to be audacious here. And it certainly motivated the never again attitude of the JDL. The Holocaust was used as a club to persuade reluctant congressmen. It was a different time, and these were a different generation of Jews. And Nixon opposed the Jackson Amendment, became the Jackson Bannock Amendment, was sponsored by Charles Bannock of Ohio, the one who interested in assisting Czech immigrants, who was of Czech origin. Golda Meir told Nixon that she would oppose Jackson Bannock in exchange for new weapons. But she was duplicitous also. At the same time, she was saying that Nechemia Levanon of Israel's liaison office sat in the Israeli embassy and worked hand in hand with the National Conference on Soviet Jewry. Some Jews, Republicans with White House access, yeah, same story, just reversed. Jacob Stein, Max Fisher, did not want to jeopardize that access by supporting the amendment, and they became terrorists. Meanwhile, the Russian activists themselves, Russian Jews, pleaded for the Jackson-Bannock Amendment, saying, do not give in to soothing deceit. Your firmness and steadfastness are our only hope. In the end, Fisher and Stein capitulated, and Nixon's efforts were appreciated formally. You know, he was against it. But when he had to come around because Congress was passing it, then he agreed, and he was thanked profusely by the Jewish community for his support of the amendment. Exactly the same thing happened with Obama, as we saw a few weeks ago. You thank people for doing what they're forced to do because that's the game that's played. In May of 73, Kissinger told Fisher and Stein that Brezhnev had agreed to release 40,000 Jews per year if the amendment is rescinded. Brezhnev himself met with Fisher and Stein in Washington in June 73, came for a summit, to tell them that there'll be no further restrictions. And he, of course, was lying. Came before the committee in October. One congressman, as far as Samuel Giddens, tried to weaken the language of the amendment, and he was attacked viciously. And he later said, congressman told him, you may be right, but the Jewish community is sticking with the 1930s. And it's so emotionally tied in with that that he will go along with genocide. Is the most emotional issue I've ever been involved in. By then, October 1973, the Yom Kippur War intervened with the Nixon airlift of weapons, the billions in aid to Israel, and Kissinger again tried to kill the bill, saying the Soviets were needed to make peace in the Middle East. But Scoop Jackson stood firm and called Kissinger a liar, and he said that Jews were being used by the administration. And if the Jews capitulate, he was a Jewish Jackson. If the Jews capitulate, the Soviets will take advantage. In the end, the House passed the amendment overwhelmingly, tying trade with freedom of immigration and other human rights. In the Senate, Javits began negotiating with the Soviets, saying that he could water down the bill if the Soviets were flexible on immigration. He floated an annual figure of 100,000 Jews to be freed. The Soviets counted 35,000 Jews. Soon after Ford became president, the negotiations included the Soviets. And finally, October 1974, the Soviets agreed to stop harassing immigrant suppliers, and they set a benchmark of 60,000 per year. Of course, the harassment continued. Around that time, Sharansky was arrested and incarcerated. The bill was signed in January 1975, but at almost the same time, another bill passed, the Export-Import Bank Bill, that permitted the president to lift the credit ceiling on loans to Soviets if national security was an issue. The point was made, but in real terms, the effect of Jackson-Bannock amendment was diluted. And yet, by 1979, 51,000 Jews left the Soviet Union, followed then by a sharp decrease. And it decreased and decreased over the ensuing years, down to 896 in 1984, 914 in 1986. And the Soviet Jewry movement really plateaued until the mid-80s, when Ronald Reagan decided to confront the Soviets directly. Mikhail Gorbachev had become a dictator in 1985. He saw perestroika, one of his words, glasnost. Perestroika was restructuring the Soviet economy and political system. In 1986, Natan Sharansky was released from prison, and the following year, days before a major summit with Gorbachev, the great rally was held in Washington, D.C. 25 years ago last week, December 6, 1987, I'm sure many of you were there. I was in a bitterly cold Sunday on the National Mall in Washington, but Sharansky termed last week in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Students and Housewives versus the Evil Empire. Some people opposed the demonstration, fearing it would embarrass Gorbachev and cause him to halt his reforms. But now we know Reagan himself pushed for the demonstration, saying he would tell Gorbachev that he, Reagan, can do nothing to help the Soviets either on arms control their economy unless the Soviets allow free immigration, saying he wanted to be able to say Gorbachev, look at the crowds, I can't go against them. House supporter was Reagan. Vice President Bush spoke at the rally. Gorbachev responded. I came home that night, and late that night and the next morning, one of my little daughters asked me, did you get the Jews out of Russia? And I said, not yet, but soon. Who knew? In 3 years, hundreds of thousands of Jews left, followed shortly thereafter by the big wave of emigration after the collapse of the USSR. But even in the Soviet Union movement, there were always very powerful counterforces, and in this instance, especially in the religious world. In 1964, from where I've been the site of Elizabeth, Zvon Lavrovo made his first trip to the Soviet Union. He met and saw Jews there in secret, and he cultivated a relationship with the Kremlin that allowed him to service the religious needs of the people, provide lots of kishtar, secretly, etc., as long as there is no publicity. And the Kremlin agreed, and there was no publicity, and Rav Heitz became an outspoken objector to public demonstrations. And many Gedolim, some of them that suffered under the communists, felt the same way. For Moshe Feinstein, for Joseph Mencken, even the Rav was against public demonstrations at one time, at other times. Many of most solidarity Sunday, right before I was at the end, they always called it a month ago, and they never canceled school for it. Public diplomacy, they were against. Pressure on the American government, they were against. For several reasons. The fear that such would harm Soviet Jews. The fear that such protests might turn violent. The fear of challenging the American government. Remember, they're a different generation. European rabbinic. And the general reliance, the preference to rely on shtadlonim that had been the way that things were always done. They never retracted. Some even opposed the D.C. rally, although over the years, their opposition became more muted. And as is the wont of true Gedolim, when the situation changed, they changed. For example, Yaakov Kamenetsky always opposed demonstrations. When he saw there was a benefit and that his fears were unjustified, he supported it. I'm indebted to Rabbi Raketa for the source of Shuk B'nai Bonin, Chalet Bey, Simon and Olive, from Yehuda Herzl Enkin, from Yosef El Hengen's grandson. It's a trip of discussing the propriety of rallies and protests, the context of Soviet Jewry. He cites the Gemara Shoshana Dafutetta and Olive. There the Jews consulted a Roman matron. But had a protested decrees, the Roman decrees, against Halatora, Ban Shmir Shabbos, Ban Mila, and she said to them, go protest loudly in public. And the Gemara says, hopeful to your people by Lido. They went out at night, but quiet and started shrieking. Homer, they said, hey Shemaya, alas the heavens, lo achachem anachnu, aren't we your brothers? Lo b'nei ovechod anachnu, lo b'nei eim achach anachnu, aren't we the children of one father, the children of one mother? What's the difference between us and every other nation? That you issue against us such harsh decrees. Who did one? And the Roman government responded to public pressure. And that day is recorded in the Gilas Hainis as the Yom Tov. Generally, Rav Henkin Sr. was quoted as saying, file this away. Should in your name, E.F. Shun's model did ring a bell of Shabbat. When it comes to reality, present reality, you can't rely on the bell you said in the past. See how the Tzias Mishnahes, reality changes. The evil Hayu Chayim Hayom, if they're alive today, Shemba Hayu Omri Macheres. Maybe they would have said something differently. You can't just parrot what they say and assume they would say the same thing forever. The Golem can change their minds, Rav Nathan wrote. Only Ketanim can change their minds. The Harbei can cool them, know them, and many, many failures that flow from this. In the end, the Soviet Jewry movement achieved its objectives in a stunning 25 years. But was it really the determinant? It's arguable whether or not it played a direct role, but clearly it played an indirect role, keeping the issue on the public agenda, giving comfort to the refuseniks, who almost all favored public demonstrations, and above all showing that Jews care. And that takes us to the third and last issue, and that is the Oslo process. Oslo raised very unique issues. It was a troubling time that hasn't fully ended, in which the public protesters were marginalized by the broader Jewish community. Oslo rested on three premises that are so bizarre in retrospect, one wonders how it was ever embraced by thinking people. One, that Yasser Arafat, Machshavah Zichro, was a statesman and a rational actor. Two, that Arafat could be trusted in reigning in terror. And three, that he could be given weapons and terror and authority over territory that would resolve the Palestinian problem and provide security and stability for Israel. It's hard to imagine anyone ever believed such nonsense, much less that they were in positions of power in Israel. So the anti-Oslo demonstrators had to overcome major hurdles, primarily that they were challenging not non-Jews, it's really easy to protest the Nazis and the Soviets, but Jews. And not only Jews, but the duly elected government of Israel. Now, some of you may recall, I had a little role in this back then. And we always held that Jewish life was at stake, and that was the most important thing. The truth is, once the Soviet Jewish movement started in the mid-1960s, few, any Russian Jews died as a result of Soviet persecution. Oslo indirectly killed almost 2,000 Jews. And we held that each of our Tzor was a mitzvah, was being trivialized and being vitiated. And we felt very strongly, I feel still today, if you allow the wolf into the hen house, the fault for the ensuing harm lies not with the wolf, but with those who allow the wolf into the hen house. And yet there's very, very little accountability in Israel. In June 1995, well over 100 rabbis descended on Washington again at the behest of the International Rabbinic Coalition for Israel. One of the rabbis there had participated in the rabbis' march in October 1943, he was in his 80s already. He held this was as important. Rabbi David Hollander moved from his activism for Soviet Jews right into his activism for Israeli Jews. And he became a tireless and vigorous opponent of Oslo well into his 90s. I remember in the late 90s, early 2000s, he would call me once a month. He was holding a press conference wanting me to stand with his constant. Died in 2009 at age 96, but he was in the cabin until the end. We had one specific mission in Washington, and that was to lobby Congress against providing any aid to the new Palestinian Authority as long as it engaged in acts of terror. It should have been a no-brainer, but the Israeli government was vehemently opposed to this effort. So I was the co-spokesman for the group. It was an ad hoc coalition, International Rabbinic Coalition of Israel. I think started 2 weeks before, and we failed that, actually, just for a number of years. Most Jewish groups, most Orthodox groups, were dead silent, were acquiescent. The exception really was the National Council of Israel, under the leadership of Rav Pesach Lerner. Most others could not overcome the awkwardness of opposing the Israeli government in public. Indeed, I remember vividly we visited the Senator Bill Bratton during the Senate time, walking to his office. If I recall correctly, I was with the Rabbi Schaffner and Willie and Neuberger and Winkler, if not all for maybe three or four. And I explained to Bill Bratton what we wanted, issue legislation, no money for the PA until they stopped terror. And he looked down at us, he said, to the pipe at everybody, he turned on what we asked, and he said, what's Israel's position? And I was left to tell him that they favor giving the aid to the Palestinians without any strings. And he paused, and he shocked, and he looked down again, and he said, wait, you are against Israel's position? And he did not comprehend how five rabbis could do that. So ingrained with his support for whatever Israel wanted. At a news conference, I was asked about this anomaly, and I stated, spread Israel TV, that it's a simple calculation, it's not even an Israeli issue. It's an American taxpayer issue, and we're American taxpayers. And I have a right to lobby my government, my congressman, as to where U.S. tax dollars should go and not go. Added this to Zinger, that if you don't want my advice, then at least take your hand out of my pocket. So in the end, for short, supposedly speaking, in the end, there was a small victory. The language was included in the legislation, but again, just like the Jackson-Vanik and the Export-Import Bank Bill, it gave the president the waiver for national security purposes that can use until today. Even though money, a lot of money goes to Hamas today under the table, they don't want to stop it. Opponents of Oslo were subjected to personal attacks, to threats of retaliation, in some cases prosecution, I maintain to this day, without real proof, but just circumstantial evidence that the Israeli government is behind it, and they use local lackeys to wage their campaign. Israeli rabbis, former Chief Rabbi Yehonda Shapira, for one, but especially the religious Zionist rabbis, were shocked and dismayed at the silence of the American rabbi. And that was June and July 1996. I was in Rabbi Shapira's study, and we consulted what to do, and he said to me very clearly, and really defined the way I know he looked at it. He said, not everyone in the army serves on the front line. That people in logistics, that people in intelligence, everyone has a role to play. He said, your battlefield is New York and Washington. That's your battlefield. And you carry out the orders as best you could. To me, to many others, truth and Torah, as I saw it, mattered more than democracy. That argument I've carried out today was the effective democracy of the Hitler, as it's elected Hamas and Morrison, as it would have elected Stalin and Brezhnev also. So democracy is a good instrument, but it's a flawed instrument. But the real Oslo, where it's flawed foundations and the explosion of terror, but what enabled it to survive really until today was the unreliability of the secular right-wing opposition in Israel. You may recall Ariel Sharon himself came here in 1995 to urge us to protest, to demonstrate, to oppose Oslo, but we all know what happened when he came to power. And our opposition suffered from a familiar syndrome as well. It also took place in the late 1930s, the Miva Roach syndrome. Who's in charge? So a number of times in the late 1990s, I participated in meetings that were designed to take all these groups and coalesce into one group. Instead of operating 5 to 10 different splinter groups, it never happened. Not because of me, I'm happy to say. It never happened. Once I remember there was an agreement to establish a governing council of 7 members of the various groups, and everyone was in agreement. And then one organization, I think it was Recruit USA, representatively could, they said, okay, well, the 7-man council, and we could get to have 5 seats on that council, since they're the largest opposition party in Israel. Literally, I walked out 30 seconds after that, because I knew nothing would come of the meeting, and indeed it broke up in animosity 20 minutes later. Many were just untrustworthy, but the opposition was important. At least that history should record that when many had lost their heads, some retained them and fought for Jewish honor. So just by summary, it's fascinating that each of the situations before us, the protests against Nazi Germany, for Soviet Jews, against the Oslo process, were always Jews in favor of protests and against protests. In favor of public diplomacy, in favor of private diplomacy. There are always geopolitical or strategic interests that have to be weighed, in addition to the parochial Jewish interests, and it's always arguable how effective any of the protests were, even the one that achieved its objectives, the Soviet Jewry movement. There are always coping arguments on all sides, but history has little patience with the timid. Indeed, what's most remarkable about all these matters is that most Jews, always remain on the sidelines, uninvolved, disengaged, silent, even during the Holocaust, during communism, and certainly during Oslo. And maybe that's the greatest and most sobering lesson of all, because there will always be future occasions when similar choices have to be made. I thank you all very much. We'll meet again next Monday night. Next Monday, I think we'll discuss the leaving Europe, Jews in the 1930s, what their options were, why they exercised it, why most did not. Look at that next week. I thank you for coming.